Thank you, Yona, very much. Rosh Hashanah the Asra, Rabbi Adler, members of my family, I'd like to acknowledge the presence of my sister, Miriam Schachter, my brother-in-law, Dr. Benjamin Gampel, who joined us this evening, and all of you, so many of whom knew our mother very, very well. It would normally be at this point when I would be beginning a talk that I was giving here in this room, and there were many over the course of the years that our mother would be present, and I would always acknowledge her presence. And in the olden days, as she got older, she would be in the wheelchair, and I would talk about Mommy and about how meaningful it was to me that Mommy was here to participate in whatever presentation that I was giving. And she's not here physically. We finished the first Yahrzeit. But I do feel that she's here, and she's very much with us and with our family on a regular basis. There are many different aspects of our mother's life and values that are worthy of analysis and discussion. And our family had the opportunity, beginning with the funeral and then during the Shiva and so many times since, to share our own recollections and reflections and focusing on the parts of her life that very much made a tremendous impact on us and on so many of you who had the opportunity to know her. But tonight I'd like to focus on Zionism. Our mother loved Israel, she loved Eretz Yisrael, and she loved Medinat Yisrael. And she traveled to Israel with our father very, very often. The first time was in 1949 when they went on their honeymoon. And they went to Israel for a number of weeks. And actually, in our family, we have, I don't even know what we call it anymore. There used to be reels, old, tiny reels, maybe 3 minutes each. We had about 20 of them that we discovered that we upgraded. And Miriam and I had a chance to look at them. And we saw what Israel looked like in 1949. And it was their first trip. And it was a memorable trip. I think the second trip was when the four of us went together within a week and a half after the end of the Six-Day War in 1967. So my father, our father, had gone in between, but I don't think that our mother went between 49 and 67, and 67 was the first time that Miriam and I went with our parents to Israel. I want to begin with the reality that was going on in Israel right after the Six-Day War. A number of you sitting here, I'm sure, remember what it was like then, although it was a very long time ago. And I find myself often thinking that the reality that we face today is a very different feeling than the feeling that we had in the wake of the extraordinary miracles of Milchemet Sheshet Hayamim. If you look on the right-hand side of the first page, I want to share with you a conversation that took place very shortly after, 2.5 months after the end of the Six-Day War. This comes from an article that was published in 2016 by an Israeli professor, Emmanuel Etkis, Kavim l'dmuta shel ha-tzionut ha-mishichit. He wants to focus on Messianic Zionism, and that's going to be a lot of the focus of my discussion tonight. About 2.5 months after the war, nifkisha bebeito shel Rav Shaar Yosef Cohen. Shaar Yosef Cohen was the chief rabbi of Haifa, and in his house there was a meeting between Kvutzat Avrechim mi-yeshivat Merkaz Harav. Merkaz Harav was under the tutelage of the Rosh Yeshiva, Rab Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who was a major messianist, and we'll see that shortly. So his Talmidim had a meeting with Manhig HaMafdal Da'az, Hasar Shapiro. Moshe Chaim Shapiro was the leader of Mafdal, of Mizrahi, of the religious Zionist movement. And together with Moshe Chaim Shapiro was Dr. Yitzhak Rafael, also a leader of religious Zionism. And the goal was, b'matara lahavi bifnehem et kriyat lo taguru shel rosh yeshiva tab. The Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Tzvi Yehuda, says, don't be afraid, don't give in. We're in an incredible moment, and we have to move forward. B'pkisha zu, dibru hatzi'irim, v'sherubam mishtatfu bigufam, b'shichur ha'aretz. At this point, these young scholars, students, many of whom themselves were in the army and participated in the liberation of some of the lands, they spoke with emunah lohetet, with a fervent faith, al hatzorech lahakim umiyad hitnachaluyot b'chol shitchei Eretz Yisrael. Every shetach of Eretz Yisrael, we have to settle, we have to move in, we have to be able to create evidence and places on the ground. And not only should we do this, and it's important to settle the length and breadth, v'chein al iser de oraisa, laseget ulahafkir biyad zarim et admuteha shel Eretz Yisrael. Now, iser de oraisa is a very strong formulation. It is biblically prohibited to give back and to remove oneself and to retreat from any piece of land that is greater Eretz Yisrael that was conquered during and as a result of the Six-Day War. It's an iser de oraisa. And on the contrary, we have to push through and we have to make this Israel's territory. So after they make their speech, so they're in the presence of very prominent and wise and well-known political leaders of the Israeli society, not only did they not, these older gentlemen, support what these young men were saying, when they responded, they said, you're naive, you're foolish, you don't know what you're talking about, you're tmimim, hatulushim in hametziyut, you're totally removed, you're cut off from the reality, you're in dreamland, that this is the way you're talking. U'bimiyuchad mimatzava ha-bein le'umi shel medinat Yisrael. Israel is part of an international community. There's a connection here between other countries that we have to keep in mind. We can't just simply do whatever it is that we want to do. B'dvarim mafchidim alachatz bein le'umi va'avdam yedidim be'umot ha'olam. And they spoke with, they scared them. If we're going to lose any support from any other nations of the world, if we're going to behave this way, and we have to be so careful. Afnisu litzaninam mehit lahavutam. And they try to cool off this enthusiasm and this excitement that these young, wonderful Jews came to demand of the leadership of the religious Zionist community. Very nice, but it's nirit kibilti realit. It's not realistic. I understand it, but you know what? Just relax. We're living in a big world, and it doesn't make sense that we should proceed along these lines. At which point, one of the young men gets up, and he says the following. And here, looks like it was a quote. This comes from an article that I told you. It comes from an article by Emmanuel Etkis, but he's quoting an article that appeared in 1971, written by Yaakov Filber, who was one of that chevra who was very much excited about and demanding and requiring, in accordance with Jewish law, iser d'oraisa, to be able to just settle wherever we have to settle. So this young man gets up and says, lo et kvoda shel Eretz Yisrael bati levakesh. I'm not only here because I want to defend and ask for the honor of the land of Israel. Ma'amin ani be'emunah shleima, I believe with a fervent faith. Ki im HaKadosh Baruch Hu natan lanu b'nisim gluyim et ha'aretz, shuv lo yotzienu miyadeinu. That's the phrase that I want to highlight as the point of departure. Once God gave it to us, we're good to go. God will never take us out of that land. The lo ovid kut shebrichu nisa l'shikra. God doesn't play games with us. God doesn't lie to us. If we had such a miracle, then it's an incredible miracle, and this miracle will be lasting. This miracle will not be able to be withdrawn. Al kein shleimutah shel eretz Yisrael eina b'tchum achlatata shel memshelet Yisrael. So the state of Israel, the authorities, the government, is not in charge anymore. This is not under the aegis of a governmental decision. This is way bigger than that. This is the Rabboni Shel Olam gave it to us, and the Rabboni Shel Olam is not going to take it away from us, because Shuv Lo Yotzienu Miyadeinu. Flush with the victory of the Six-Day War, overwhelmed by the miracles, intoxicated by the euphoria, they demanded and that they required that the state of Israel act in a geopolitical way on the ground, claiming God wants this, and God absolutely prohibits any other perspective. So we were in Israel a couple of, maybe 10 days after the end of the Six-Day War, and some of you may have been there that summer. And to say euphoria is an understatement. It was unbelievable what was going on at that time. The sense of a miracle, mamish nisim gluyim, the sense that God did something so extraordinarily amazing for the Jewish people, it was palpable. I remember, and it sounds a little strange to me now, but I remember explicitly that if somebody at that time would have said to me, go to the Aron Kodesh, open it up, put your hand on the Sefer Torah and swear a Shavua de'oraisa that Mashiach is coming, I would have been prepared to do that. That's how convinced I was. I was 16 years old, so I was young, but I mamish felt that the euphoria was extraordinary that Mashiach was coming. And these young men who felt that euphoria translated it into behavior that they felt was important for the state of Israel to undertake. Contrast that to the left side of page one. In 1974, there was a debate on the pages of, I'm going to say, the late Shema magazine. It just closed up shop maybe 2 weeks ago. After, I think, about a 50-year run. Shema magazine was a journal founded by a Reform rabbi, Rabbi Eugene Borowitz, which was a platform for very interesting discussion cross-denominational within the Jewish community on issues of general concern. There's a debate here between Rabbi Schubert Spiro, who was then the rabbi of the Young Israel of Cleveland, and Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, who was then the rabbi of the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Rabbi Spiro took a very strong messianist position. It's now 1974. And Dr. Lamb pushed back against that position. And I want to place at the beginning these two perspectives. One, a very strong, this is it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a nest. We're not going back. We could do whatever we want. It's not for you to decide. It's not for the government to decide. The Rabbanim Shel Olam already decided. And on the other hand, a different perspective, a calmer, unmessianic perspective. Wrote Dr. Lamb, left side, I must make it clear that I do not deny that ours is an era of incipient messianic redemption. I'm not saying that it's not messianic. What I am saying is that I do not know whether it is or not. And I challenge the certainty of those who assert such superior knowledge. It may be, but it may not be. I just don't know. And not only don't I know, But I challenge anybody who thinks that they do know. What right do you have? How do you know? I consider it spiritually presumptuous to declare without benefit of prophetic inspiration that we are privy to divine secrets. God's plans are known to us only retrospectively. And he quotes the pasuk, Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to see God. And God said, you can't see me in the front, you'll only see my back. Which he understands to mean, not just you see God's back, but you can only understand the way God operates in history after the events happen. From the back, you can't see it at the beginning. The ways of God in history are too wondrous, too mysterious for us either to deny or to assert that we are in a particular phase of a preordained drama. One thing we can learn from current history is that we are unredeemed and we need the Messiah. One thing we can learn from past history is that it is dangerous to pretend to know when he is coming or came. My commitment to the state of Israel does not require messianic presuppositions. That commitment was forged in the fires of the crematoria and the hatred of and indifference to Jews by the so-called civilized countries of the West, and a love of Eretz Yisrael and Am Yisrael, which are the purpose of Medinat Yisrael, in the expectation that Torah has a better chance in Israel today than in the diaspora. Therefore, especially because I can get along without a messianic undergirding for my love of Israel, I will not risk a premature messianism, which history has taught us can lead to psychological and spiritual disasters. When I came to the Jewish Center in 1981, there was a rabbi in between Dr. Lamb and myself, the late Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, Zichrono Livracha, who was there for 4 years. I came in, my first Shabbos, I'm nervous about my sermons, my first Shabbos, and all I'm thinking about, beginning from Moda Ani until the time I have to give my sermon, is my sermon, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be meichel me that I don't think I heard a word of Kriyas HaTorah, or at all knew what the davening was for that day. And now we're coming down towards the time of the sermon. So the Gabbai comes over and hands me the text of the prayer for the government. The rabbi has to say the prayer for the government, so many shuls do, like our shul. In our shul, the Gabbai says it. In the Jewish Center, the rabbi said it. Ich kikun the tefillah for the government. And it was totally alien to me. I had never seen this prayer. This was a totally different prayer. Forget Avinu Shebashamayim, Tzur Yisrael VeGoalo. I had been reciting that for many years in my previous pulpit. And now they give it to me, and I don't know what I'm looking at. But I don't have time, because Mahal Shem Ba'ashrei, so I don't have time to say, excuse me, what happened? Maybe you have another one. And I have to begin to focus on it, because when I read it, I don't want to be foolish that I can't read Hebrew on my first Shabbos as the rabbi of the shul. So I'm chazering it over, and I read it, and I read it, and then after davening, I went to Dr. Lamb, and I said, what's this? He said, well, in our shul, we do not say the tefillah l'shlom ha-medina. We do not believe that the state of Israel is reshit tzmichat geulateinu. We have a whole different tefillah. I said, what's the basis? He said, I published an article in Shema in 1974. Go look up my article. And I did. And then after I read it, I went to him and I said, I'm not comfortable. Everybody in the world, everybody I know, all the communities that I know say this prayer. Yeah, I know it's problematic. I'm not really sure. But would you mind if I instituted it in our shul? I feel like we should be sort of part of the mainstream. And in an act of incredible chesed, he was president of Yeshiva University for a number of years. I was just about 30 years old. He said, you're the rabbi, whatever you want to do, please feel free and go ahead. But he didn't say Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu, because he was not prepared to say it's not. But he was not prepared to say that it is. So I want to bracket this debate, and I want to now analyze a halacha in Hilchas Chanukah, and then I want to come back to understand this tension about what is Medinat Yisrael today. We have now two different, very different perspectives. See it through the lens of a discussion of one of the laws of Hanukkah. So the Gemara in Shabbos, page 2, Chafalof Amid Beis, Tana Rabbana. Ner Chanukah mitzvah lahanicha Pesach beso mi bachutz. It's a mitzvah to put the Chanukah candles on the door outside. Imaya darba aliyah, if you live upstairs, meinicha b'chalon asmucha l'rishus harabba. There's a special inyan of persume nisa, so it should either be outside or it should be where it's visible from the outside. U'b'shas ha-sakana. These are the few words that I want to focus on. U'b'shas ha-sakana meinicha al shulchano v'dayo. In the time of a sakana, it's dangerous. It's dangerous to light outside. It's dangerous for the candles to be visible. So it's okay, you could light on your dining room table, and that's good enough. What's the sakana, what's the danger? So there's a 3 or 4 way machlokes rishonim here to define the danger. If you look at Rashi, ha-sakana, a little more than halfway down on the left side, Shahaya lahem leparsiyim, he quotes a Gemara Masachas Gittin, Shahaya lahem leparsiyim chok biyom edam, the Parsiyim had a rule on their holiday, Shalo yav iru ner elo bebeis avodazara shalohem, that the only place where you could have a candle lit is in their religious space, nowhere else, so therefore you can't light anywhere else because it's a sakana, and they're going to go and they'll punish you if they find you're violating their rule. If you look in Taisvis, Ubishas HaSakana, Nira Lari, Taisvis quotes a Gemara later on in Masech HaShabbos, which is at the bottom of the page, Daf Mem Hei Amid Aleph, Nira Lari, Dehainu, Michi Asu Chavre LeBavel, when the Chaborin came to Bavel. What happened when the Chaborin came to Bavel? That's the Gemara below. So Rashi below has two interpretations. V'heim gozru shalo lahadlik. There was sort of a generic gzera that you're not allowed to light any candles. Inami, says Rashi, b'yom chagam ein manichem lidlok or ela bebeis avodah zara. The second interpretation of Rashi is like the Rashi in our sugya on Daf Chaf Aleph, that there's a special rule that light can only be lit in their houses of worship. And the first interpretation of Rashi is it's a general, generic gezerah that they didn't allow Jews to light candles. If you look at Tosfos in Shabbos Daf Mem Hei, Tosfos also quotes both interpretations. Shabiyom chag shelohem dibra mascha mikame chavre or chabore bishabato. Shabiyom chag shelohem lo hayu manichem ner elo bebeis avodah zara, which is the first interpretation that Rashi gave. Then at the end of Tosfos, inami, the shas ha-sakana in our Gemara is not about the sakana of chaborim, ela sakonas gezeira shegozru shelo lahadlik, a general gezeira. So if it's a sakana, if it's dangerous, either because there's a specific issue, you can't light anywhere other than their houses of worship, or because they generally asser you, they prohibit you from lighting candles. So in that case, then you don't have to sacrifice your life. It's okay to light at home. Turn to page 3. So I did some research and I went through a number of different sources, both in Germany and in Spain and in Provence. And we have all different kinds of explanations and approaches. If you look at the Rav Yah on the top right of page 3, who lived at the beginning of the 13th century, he explains that it's talking about Sha'anu Dorim, 4 lines from the bottom, Sakana Achariti Kegon Sha'anu Dorim Bein Hagoyim. It's a sort of, we live among the Goyim. It's not that there's a Gzera, and it's not that we can only light, only there are a lot of light, but we can't light. You know what? Don't start messing with the Goyim. You're living among Goyim. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't want to light outside. That itself is a sakana. That's the third interpretation. The Ritva on the left-hand side, on the top left-hand side, we're now into the 14th century. Afilu sakana tsar oh, Ava. I'm nervous. Ava is that they hate us. They're going to make us suffer. There's no specific issue here, but just living among Gentiles is a source of concern. The bottom left hand, the Rabbeinu Yerucham, who was Provençal, and then he moved to Spain. Four lines from the bottom. Mishum de shchichi goyim veganovim. Shchichi goyim veganovim. Again, you don't know. You're living among Gentiles. It's a sakana. You never know what's going to be. And at the top of page four, from the Rivash as well, you don't know what the Gentiles can do for you, and therefore it's a danger. So whatever the issue, the definition of sakana, we're living in a place and in a time when we feel vulnerable. We feel like somebody's going to get us. Somebody is going to destroy us. Somebody is going to act out against us. And so therefore, whatever the circumstances may be, we saw a number of different options. B'shas ha-sakana, so then you light inside. The Mechaber Paskins, let's go to the bottom of page four, the fourth line. U'b'shas ha-sakana, she'eno rasho'i l'kayim ha-mitzvah, me'nicho al shulchano v'daya. So this halacha in the Gemara is Paskin in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch defines she'eno rasho'i l'kayim ha-mitzvah, for whatever the rationale may be, but we're not really in a position to fulfill the mitzvah fully by lighting a candle outside, and we're nervous, and we're worried, and it's dangerous, so we light on our tables, and that is good enough. A little bit further down, a couple of lines later, Rav Moshe Issala says, Umihu, bizman hazeh, shekulanu madlikim bifnim. Rav Moshe Issala, 16th century Poland, bizman hazeh, everybody lights inside. The question was raised already earlier in the 13th century at the top of page 5. Let's say it's not a sakana. Let's say God is good and we're living in a place and in a time when we don't have to worry. Should we now revert and go back to lighting outside? Is the only reason why we're not lighting outside is because b'shas sakana? But now, if there's no sakana, maybe we should actually go and do it the old-fashioned way, the way the Gemara says that it should be done. The issue is explicitly raised by Rabbi Yitzchak Or Zeruah, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Moshe, who lived in the 13th century, died in the last part of the 13th century, was in Vienna, and he mentions u'b'shas ha-sakana, that they did not allow us to light candles. And then five lines from the bottom, really interesting. V'ha'idna deleka sakana, lo yodana mai taima enanu madlikim b'chatzeros. We don't have a sakana. You have to do a lot of research into what's going on in Vienna in the second half of the 13th century. It's quite remarkable. No sakana. And yet, we're still lighting inside. Est Rabbi Yitzchak or Zeruah, why are we lighting inside? There is no sakana. Lo yodana, I don't know. And he leaves it as a question. My taima ain anu madlikin bechatzeros. And we don't, but we should. In the Sefer Ha'itur, in the middle of page 5, this is a earlier 12th century text. He states simply, once we do it that way, that's the way we do it. The achashe nagu ala sakana nagu. And the commentaries explain that in a sense, this is an answer to the question that was posed later by the Or Zeruah. We don't change a lot. We do things the old way. We keep on doing things the old way. So why do we continue to light inside? Because we continue to light inside. Azay fiert men zach. Azay te tate getan. Azay te zeide getan. Don't tell me times have changed. This is what we do. And this is considered, perhaps, to explain why even though circumstances may change, still the halachic behavior does not change. The Orach HaShulchan at the bottom of page 5, the Munkacha Rebbe the Admor mi Munkat Rab Chaim Elazar Shapiro on page 6, all struggle to try to understand why is it that we still keep on lighting inside, even in circumstances where maybe it's better. Why did the Ramah say, asks the Munkacher on page 6, why did the Ramah say, V'hoidna, we light inside? So he starts to think, well, maybe what's going on in Krakow in the middle of the 16th century, it was a sakana, but all of a sudden they're playing historian because he wants to understand, was there a sakana, was there not a sakana? But if there is no sakana, then why is it that we, in fact, continue to light inside? This is an issue that has occupied a lot of poskim and rabbinic authorities for a very long time. Until we come to page 7, an article that was published in a journal called Yeshurun in the year 2010. The author of this article says, you know what? We're living in Israel now. We're living in Israel. Baruch Shechianu v'kimanu v'gianu l'zman hazeh. We're living in Israel. For living in Israel, there is no sakana. We don't have a sense of sakana living in Israel. So I suggest and I move that we should change the custom and we should all light outside. And he quotes some posek who tries to come up with a rationale to continue to light inside. And 10 pages later, in the course of this interesting article, he rejects it. It doesn't make any sense. And he says, just the first line or two at the top of page 7, Hine zochinu be'eretz hakodesh, she'anachnu dorim bein achenu b'nei Yisrael, ve'ein eva v'sakana klal, lahadlik neirot chanukah b'pesach beito b'chalono aponel l'rishus harabim. So that's what we should do. And I read this article in 2010, and I was very struck by it. Here's somebody who says, you know what? When the reality changes, you live in accordance with the reality. You're going to tell me the Bubis and the Zaydis and the Elta Bubis, it's a new world now. And if it's a new world, so the principles should now revert back to the way it was originally established. I'm not changing the law. I'm in accordance with the law. On the contrary, there's more of a reason for me to be in accordance with the law if there's no sakana for me to light outside. And I'm waiting. My principle always is when I'm reading articles and I do research is when somebody says something a little bold or a little interesting or a little unique or a little edgy, yeah, change the custom, somebody is going to go after that. So you have to just wait. You have to just wait. I always love letters to the editor much more than I love the article because that's where the gloves come off and say, Titzach of Tish and of Bank. That's where it gets labedic. You know, you say something very nice, and then it starts. And then it starts. So in 2013, there's a journal called Kovetz Beis Aaron v. Yisrael. Comes out from the Karliner Stolen Chassidim. I subscribe to this journal, Kovetz Beis Aaron v. Yisrael. And sure enough, in 2013, there's an article by a Rav Menachem Zilberberg who goes after the article in Yeshurun in 2010. And he says it's a Beferisha Ramah. The Ramah says, V'ho'idna, we light inside. Milan Ugadlo from the Ramah, you're going to start messing around with the Ramah. The Ramah says you have to light inside. And all great Gedolei Yisrael lit inside. And he goes through a whole list of times when Jews had it good and they still lit inside. So Feshtetzach, of course, you have to light inside. Then he comes to the state of Israel. V'ra'isi, now at the in the middle of the page, and I saw in this article in Yeshurun 22, Shekatav l'chalek, we're now at the narrow section in the middle of page 7, Shekatav l'chalek bein ha'tkufot ha'shalvot shebe'avar l'tkufa d'hayom. You have to differentiate between, in the olden days when things were quiet, to the reality of what's going on today. To us, why is it that even when it was quiet in the 15th century, in the 16th century, in the 17th century, they still insisted that they should light inside because they were worried, Shema yachzer amatzav likil kulo, v'yachzeru ashmados. we'll be in trouble again before you turn around. Vayokam Melech Chadash, and there'll be a new decree, and we'll start all over again. So why am I going to move it out? Because for the next 7 minutes, I can breathe easily, because in 9 minutes from now, I'm going to have to bring it back in again. So that's why in the past, when things were okay, says Rabbi Zilberberg regarding the previous author, that's why they didn't make the change. But v'lochein lo itchilu lahadlik b'chutz, mashenken kayom, tachat hashilton ha-yisraeli, lekach shashzeh, we're living in Israel, we're good to go. It's not going to go back. It's never going to revert back. This is it. And it's going to be fine. And therefore, go out there and light. What are you worried about? You'll never have to pull it back. Because you're living in the land of Israel. You're living in the state of Israel. Tachat hashilton ha-yisraeli. Ulami says, I disagree. Because, I mean, very nice, but how do you know what's going to happen? How do you know what's going to happen in the state of Israel? Ulam davar zeh no al pi mabat mitziyuti. It's not realistic. Ki chol bar dat mevinet matzavenu kayom. Everybody knows where we are today in 2013, what the reality is. Ki bederech hateva, under normal circumstances, e efshar lismoch al hashilton hazeh, shemisugal limnoa chazarat hamatzav lekilkulo chas v'shalom. How do you know that we're not going to revert back? We're having a difficult time in the year 2013. Va'al titalel ki lo teda mayulad yo. Now the truth is that the first author, did not make this distinction. The first author did not say, nowhere in the article, and after I read this, I went back, and I read the article twice carefully, nowhere does he say that there's a difference between the olden days when even when it was good, we're still nervous that it might revert, as opposed to today. He doesn't say that. And frankly, it doesn't matter. Because if it's good now, so do it now. Technically speaking, if there's no sakana, the Gemara says, go out there. Nu nebuch, if you have to bring it back, so you'll bring it back. Logically, it doesn't make sense, and he doesn't say it. And he also never says that the state of Israel is irreversible. He does not say that in his article. This Rabbi Menachem Zilberberg is prepared to suggest that, and therefore says, according to that rationale, that it may turn bad. Well, chas v'shalom, it may turn bad. And so I began to think, and I've been thinking for a long time, so what is the theological significance? What is Medinat Yisrael, and how are we mityaches to Medinat Yisrael, which was a major love of our mother? Now, from the beginning, and this is a long story, from the beginning, the primary ideologues of early religious Zionism, already in the 19th century, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, Rabbi Shmuel Molyever, Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai, spoke about the nascent Zionist movement and return of the Jews to Israel in messianic terms. They refer to it as Geula, as redemption. They utilized a lot of Mamore Chazal in the context of Kachi Geulatan Shel Yisrael, Kim'ah, little by little. It's not going to happen in 1 second. It happens little by little. And this is in the 19th century where the Zionist movement is first beginning to gain a lot of steam. There's a lot of opposition in the traditional Jewish community, but they felt very strongly that this is something that should be supported. The bottom of page 7, I found recently in a book by Aryeh Morgenstern, says something that was very striking to me. In the year 1836, when now already into the 19th century, in 1836, the Jewish community known as the Prushim at that time, that was the name of the group of Jews who were living in Yerushalayim, got permission to rebuild the Churva Shul. So we've all been to Yerushalayim, we've been to the Eir Atika, we've been to the Churva Shul. When we were there in 1967, it was Taka a Churva. It was totally a Churva. After a while, all that was built was this arch, the semicircle arch, but it was mamish rubble. And of course, over time, it was rebuilt. In 1836, Jews, for the first time living in Yerushalayim, were given an opportunity to rebuild the Chatzer of the Churva. And they said at that time, end of line 3, Simana Milsahi Atchalto de Geula. Oh, Mashiach is coming. It's the Hatchala of the Geula. Already redemption is on the way. Next line, Yerushalayim Omrim Shekvar Hitchila HaGeula. This is a major, major accomplishment to be able to start rebuilding. This is a big deal to start rebuilding the Chor V'Shul. The top of page 8 is a tshuva that was written by Reb Shia LeKutna, who was one of the great Gedolei Yisrael at the end of the 19th century. And he's writing here a tshuva Simen Samach Vav in Shailsul Tshuvas Yeshuos Malko. And the issue is about, is there an obligation to go to live in Israel today? Today being in 1893, that's when he's writing this tshuva. And he says that there is an obligation. He says, according to the Ramban, who says that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is the mitzvah saseh, the Ramban really only means when you could actually own it, when you could actually take authority over it. But today we can't really do that. He uses a phrase of the Gemara in Maseches Yuma. He says, our coming is like a bia reikonis. It's like an empty coming, because it's not like we can exercise any authority over it. But he says, ve'ein safek, on the top left of the page, a little bit further down, about a little more than halfway, ve'ein safek shehi mitzvah gedola, 1893, ki hakibbutz hu atchalta de geula. And what I have been doing over the course of a number of years is I'm interested in this trajectory of references to, there's no state of Israel, this is 1893, it's the Hatchala of the Geula, framing what's going on, utilizing Messianic language. And of course, my go-to would be Rav Kook. I would have imagined that Rav Kook, who's sort of the arch power of religious Zionism, and knowing his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who was incredibly Messianic. So I searched through the writings of Rav Kook, and I came across just a few references. On the middle of page 8, Reshit Smichat Yeshuat Yisrael. Reshit Smichat, the beginning of the flourishing of the salvation of Israel. In a letter that he wrote in 1913, at the bottom of page 8, he refers to what's going on, Ve'ein Safek, Shehatnua HaGedola Hazot Hi Atchalta de Geula. The top of page 9 in 1920, Reshit Smichat Geulat Amenu. So we have here repeated messianic language. But what's most strong for me, though it's most dispositive, is the next source in Orot HaTchiya from Rav Kook, Ma'amin Hu Ha'am Kulo. She'ein galut od acharei hageula haholechet umatchelet shelofanim. There will never be another galus. Now that we're starting a geula, Orot HaTchiya of Rav Kook, he died in 1935, Orot HaTchiya of Rav Kook, we're good to go, there will never be another galus. The trajectory that we are now, that is now underway, will continue and continue and continue. It's a very famous phrase that was coined by Rav Herzog, who was the successor of Rav Kook as the Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi of Israel. And I give you a few sources. We'll just look at the first one. 1941, Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Alevi Herzog came to the United States. In 1941, he had a meeting with President Roosevelt, and we know a lot about the meeting that he had with Roosevelt. And at that time, Rommel, who was the German general in charge of the Middle East, was getting closer and closer and closer to the land of Israel. In Egypt, there was a whole campaign, a Middle East campaign. And let's look at the middle of page 9. In 1941, Kishamad Rommel b'sha'arei ha'aretz va'avi zatzal, this was written by his son, Yaakov Herzog, Biker Azbe, Washington. His hero, Hanasi Roosevelt, Shelo lachzor le'eretz Yisrael. You know, you better not go back because it's dangerous because the Nazis are just about ready to conquer the land of Israel. You're here in the United States. You should stay here. You'll be much safer. Ha'omedet lehi kavesh b'yedei ha'garmanim heishiv lo avi shehanevi'im nib'u al shnei chorbanot lo al chorban shlishi. In other formulations, the bottom of page 9 and the top part of page 10, chorban shlishi lo yehiyah. Once we have in Israel, once we have Medinat Yisrael, and this is even before Medinat Yisrael, Korban Shlishi Lo Yehiyeh. And so what we have, we will always have. And it will always continue. And it will not go back. I've spoken in the past here as well about the phrase that we do recite here in our shul and so many other shuls of Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, so much so that my kids and grandchildren make fun of me because they hear it from me so often. It's become a phrase in our family. When we want to talk about something that's on the way, we say it's the Reshis of the Tzmichas. That's our little shortcut about how to describe it. All of this is, we have it, Baruch Hashem, Shechianu, V'kiyamanu V'gyanu L'zman Hazeh, and we're here to stay, and we're good to go, and nothing is going to change. Turn to page 12. Two more sources on the Messianic end, and then on the other end. In 1953, top right, page 12. In 1953, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, 1953, just shortly after the founding of the State of Israel, wrote in a newspaper article, second line, Midabrim al Atchalta de Geula, 1953, Lida'ati Zehu Kvar Emtza HaGeula. 1953, it's not the beginning, but give me a Reishis, Smichas, it's the Emtza, we're already in the middle of the Geula. And after the Yom Kippur War, Rav Tzvi Yehuda was incredibly charif and very sharp. The bottom right of page 12. This is a conversation that he had with an interview that was published in Ma'ariv in 1974. And I want to read it because this really sharpens this part of the argument. Hachiyuv shel vahorashtem et haaretz v'yishavtem ba, the obligation to take, to inherit the land and to live there, that the land will be ours and we'll never give it up to anybody else, hu mitzvat aseh deoraita. Just like there's an issa deoraita to give anything back, holding on to it is a mitzvat aseh deoraita berura umuchlete. This is not open to discussion. This is absolutely clear. Klal Yisraelit, it's the totality of the Jewish people. Sha'ala ha'aretz hazot l'chol gvuloteha, anu mechuyavim b'mesirut nefesh, kishemagia matzav shel kifia. If somebody is going to force us to leave, we have to be moser nefesh. We have to give up our lives. Im tihye mitzad goyim, if the Gentiles are going to force us to leave, O ilu chalila mitzad Yehudim, biglal shibushe politika, v'shibushe deot, based on a confusion and a lack of understanding and blunders, if Jews are going to think that we're going to be able to give anything back, kulanu mechuyavim, you see the next three words, lehareg v'lo la'avor, tzihareg v'yavor, you have to give up your life, you're not allowed to let this happen. Al Yehuda v'Shomron, al Ramat HaGolan, ze lo yelech b'li milchama. We're going to fight for this. Mishu sha'al oti, says Rav Tzvi Yehuda, somebody asked me, im b'rtzoni la'asot milchemet achim, what you're going to have now, Jews, it's a civil war. You're going to have Jews now fighting against other Jews. Is that what you want? Ani lo ekanes l'terminologia. I don't want to get into terminology. I don't know how to call it. I don't want to get into discussion about what to name it. Aval zu uvda, it's a fact. Ze lo yelech. It's not going to happen. Ze lo yavor b'li milchama al gufotenu v'al evarenu kulanu. Lo hagoyim yatzlichu baze v'lo sibuchim politiyim mishalanu b'shum ofen sheba'olam. There's no way we can give anything back. You want to give it back? I'm going to stand here. I'm not going to allow you to give it back. You want to call it a civil war? I don't want to say that's what it is, but that's what it is. Which means that we're convinced that it's not just the beginning of the Geula, but Mahal Shein Be'emtza HaGeula. And once you're Be'emtza HaGeula, you don't have to worry about what other nations say. You don't have to worry about realpolitik, because God is on your side. It's not up to the government to make these decisions. These decisions are made by the Rabbanu Shalom. And it's an Issa D'Oraisa. It's an Issa D'Oraisa. Nothing stronger than an Issa D'Oraisa to give back, or a mitzvat aseh mid D'Oraisa to stay here. An alternative perspective was provided by Rav Yehuda Amital, the Rosh Yeshiva for many years, the founder of Yeshivat Har Etzion. Before we get to Rav Amital, I want to get to Rabbi Joseph P. Soloveitcher. Just for a moment, turn back to page 11. In 1975, 1 year after Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook announces in the newspaper that it's going to be a civil war, and we're going to not allow anything, it's Issa D'Oraisa to give anything back. So Rabbi Joseph P. Soloveitcher has an interview in Ma'ariv in September of 1975. The middle of the left side. Do you support the peace proposal of Dr. Henry Kissinger and the new proposed interim agreement between Israel and Egypt that are currently in the offing? Says Rabbi Soloveitcher, I do not live in Eretz Yisrael. I have no right to express my opinion on these matters. It's really a fascinating concept. Not a wrong concept. Then on the right-hand side, then he asked further, a lengthy discussion ensued between the Rav and I, this is the interviewer, and in its wake he agreed to express his viewpoint regarding the issue in general. The right-hand side. Let me share with you a story I heard from Avi Mori Zal, my father, in the name of his father, Reb Chaim Brisker. The end of World War I, when Reb Chaim was living in Minsk, the non-Jews undertook a series of pogroms against the Jewish populace. One day, a number of Jews, and Rav Chaim was among them, were discussing the murders and destruction that had ravaged the Jewish communities. One Jew said, ah, if only we knew that this suffering was Chevle Moshiach. If only we knew that what we are facing now are the birth pangs of the Messiah, then somehow it would be easier for us to deal with this, without finishing his sentence. On the spot, Rav Chaim responded that he does not accept such a statement. The Jew looked at him and said, what did I say that Your Honor doesn't agree with? I didn't say anything. Reb Chaim said, you said much, you said too much. You said that if these were the birth pangs of the Messiah, as if to say, that if they're the birth pangs of the Messiah, then it would have been worth the suffering. It's worth the suffering because I'm hearing the footsteps of the Mashiach. And to this I do not agree, because it runs contrary to the halacha. If the halacha states that pikuach nefesh overrides the entire Torah, it overrides the coming of the Messiah too. Nothing can justify suffering. Nothing. Pikuach nefesh is more important than the coming of the Mashiach. Who says that the Messiah will come through the shedding of innocent blood? There are many ways for the Almighty to bring the redemption without the spilling of Jewish blood. So declared the Zayde, Reb Chaim Brisker, regarding this issue, let me, his grandson, Rabbi Joseph P. Soloveitcher, say, when one is required to feed an ill person on Yom Kippur, so who paskens the Shaila? If you're allowed to feed an ill person on Yom Kippur, you go to the doctor. It's done upon the advice of the experts, the doctors. In the areas of territory, policy, and pikuach nefesh, the experts are the chief of staff and the leadership of the Israel Defense Forces and the government of Israel. If they will conclude that it is possible to compromise over territory without threatening the life of the yeshuv and the existence of the state, we should rely upon them. Isidar Raisahin, Isidar Raisahair, ask the government. The government decides. The generals, they know. They have a sense of what the security situation is like. They're the experts. What, you're going to paskin in the Beis Medrash? Whether or not somebody's allowed to eat on Yom Kippur? What, you're going to paskin in the Beis Medrash? Whether or not you're allowed to give back territory or not allowed to give back territory? You have to ask the people who are the experts. And anyway, I live in America, so I don't have a right to say anything about this. Rav Yehuda Amital did not live in America, left side of page 12. He lived in Israel. He was one of the leaders in Israel. He was a Nitzol HaShoah. He was a Holocaust survivor. And in 2006, there was an article that was published in Tradition, in the journal called Tradition. It's a sicha that he gave in 2005 in Yeshivat Har Etzion. And I just want to read part of it to you because it's very powerful and it resonates deeply to me. After the Oslo Accords, when Israel transferred a few cities to Palestinian control, I participated in a panel discussion in New York with some other Israeli rabbis. One of the questions raised was whether it's still possible to speak of Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu following the handing over of territories to the Palestinians. You understand that when Yamit and what happened in Gaza, the Nisiga from Gaza, was a major trauma, massive trauma for the religious Zionist community, because now we're giving back. Rav Tzvi Yehuda says, you can't give back, we'll never give back. It's all in one direction. It's going from here to here to here to here, and all of a sudden, there's a retreat. It was major. There was talk about establishing a Tainus Tzibur. There should be a Tainus Tzibur. The chief rabbi of Israel wrote an article. Maybe we should establish a fasting on the day that they had to give back, or they gave back part of the Gaza Strip, or the whole control of whatever they had in the Gaza Strip. So how can you say Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu presupposes a certain trajectory, and now we're giving back? One of the speakers answered that if Rav Kook spoke about the beginning of the flowering of our redemption in his time, we can certainly speak in such terms in our times. In response, I said that with all due respect to the teachings of Rav Kook, a Holocaust happened in between Rav Kook and now. Hence, I would not talk about drawing inferences from Rav Kook's time to ours. It's not like there's a straight trajectory here. Rather, I would say that if we believed in the beginning of the flowering of our redemption in 48, after the Shoah, then we could certainly use this term after the Oslo Accords. Page 13. At the same time, after the Six-Day War, some Jews stood up and said that the partition of the land that had been forced upon us by the United Nations should be nullified. One of these people was Professor Yisrael Eldad, who said, Shanganik with the partition, we're done with the partition, let's get back to the greater land of Israel. These people began to speak about a vision of a complete Eretz Yisrael, but they didn't notice the Arabs living within the borders of that whole land of Israel. At the time of the establishment of the state, the Arab population was relatively small. There was a chance that the Jewish nation could remain the majority, but now, after we have Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, there arises a risk that the state will not remain Jewish. For this reason, next paragraph, since the Six-Day War, no government of Israel has dreamed of annexing Judea, Samaria, and Gaza as part of the state of Israel. Annexing Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, how long could we hold on without giving the Arabs the right to vote? Two approaches were proposed to deal with the problem of how to retain all of the land despite the demographic issue. Now, my intention is not to get involved in the politics. My intention is to maintain a focus on the theology here, on the theory. What do we understand to be, and what are the implications of what we understand to be the place and the role and the reality of the state of Israel today? Two approaches were proposed to deal with the problem of how to retain all of the land despite the demographic issue. One fundamentally secular approach was Rechavam Ze'evi, who said, transfer the Arabs. Aside from the moral problem involved, no Arab state has ever agreed to take the Arabs. Second approach, whose proponents included religious people, this is the one that I find compelling in terms of this presentation. The second approach, whose proponents include religious people with a zealous vision of greater Eretz Yisrael, claimed that the solution would be found with the coming of the Mashiach. And since the Mashiach is already knocking at the door, then there's no need to worry about the pragmatic, actual ramifications of our actions. My Mashiach is here already. He'll take care of it. You can do whatever you want. You don't have to worry that there's going to be some kind of a backlash. What's for a backlash? Mashiach will take care of you. This messianic thinking, which perceived the Mashiach as already lurking somewhere in the Jerusalem mountains, soon to be revealed to us, is what led to this view, to my sorrow. Counter-argument. I have not merited divine inspiration. Full circle back to Dr. Lamb at the beginning of this presentation. I've never met a prophet who fit all of the Rambam's identifying criteria who told me that the Mashiach is already on the way. When I established Yeshivat Eretz Yon, the architect who designed the Beit Midrash planned it without windows. I told her about the tzaddik in whose town a shofar blast was once heard, and the whole community thought the Mashiach was coming, or the Mashiach had already arrived. The tzaddik poked his nose out of the window, and he sniffed, and he said, no. When the Mashiach arrives, it'll be possible to sense it in the air. A Beis Medrash needs windows in order to be able to sense when the Mashiach is coming. If I haven't yet sensed that the Mashiach's footsteps, it's a sign the Mashiach hasn't come yet. So therefore you can't draw any conclusions. And you can't claim that the Mashiach is on its way. How do you know? Hopefully he is. But there's no way that I could possibly know that for sure. So should one today light outside? Should one today not light outside? What about in America? What about in our town? It's not so pushit. We're going through difficulties in America. Is that a reason not to light outside? Should we light outside? How do we define Makom Sakana in Tinek? How do we define Makom Sakana in America? And how do we define Makom Sakana in Medinat Yisrael? To take a position on this question, I think is fundamentally important to us. It's a complicated question. It's an unpleasant question. But I think it's a very important question because I think it has ramifications in terms of how we understand the state of Israel. Should it be? Will it be? Of course, Emir Tzah Hashem. That's obviously what we hope for. And Emir Tzah Hashem, that's what we believe in. Our mother loved Medinat Yisrael. She loved Israel. Towards the end of her life, Miriam and Abi, her son, and Yocheved and I took her to Israel about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago. She was very old. She was in a wheelchair, and she was over 90 or just about 90. She wanted to go to Israel, so we took her to Israel. And it was difficult. It was difficult to get around. So we would take a taxi wherever we went. And it was a whole ordeal. We had to get her out of the wheelchair and put her on the front seat next to the taxi driver, take the wheelchair, fold it up, put it in the back and in the trunk and close it. And we would sit in the back. And every single time she would start a conversation, Tagidli hanahag hayakar, ani sakranit. Eifo noladita. Anisakranit means I'm curious. Tell me, where were you born? And out comes fascinating stories. Kurdistan, Iraq, Iran, Tayman. One day we get into a cab. Anisakranit, Eifo noladita. Noladiti bi'ir ha'atika. So our mother says, chaval. Sheha'aravim gershu et ha'yehudim meha'ir ha'atika. At which point the Nahag says, Giveret, ani aravi. At which point our mother says, oh, anachnu kulanu b'nei dodim, anachnu ohavim echad et ha'sheni, kavod gadol b'shvili liyod ba'oto shalcha. Boom, in a second she tried to pulled the shovel right out of her mouth, and it was very beautiful. But it spoke to the incredibly intense connection that she had to Israel, and it was a reflection of her personality as well. I want to conclude in 30 seconds with last week's parsha, this week's parsha, Parshas Chayei Sarah. Avraham Avinu had 10 tests. What were the 10 tests of Avraham? Asor nisyonos nisnasu Avraham Avinu. What was the last test? So you all learned in school, the last test of the Asara Nisyonos is Akedas Yitzchak. That's what everybody says, except for the Rabbeinu Yonah. The Rabbeinu Yonah says the last test was Kavur Asara, the beginning of Chayasar. And the Lashon of the Rabbeinu Yonah is that you were told that you are going to get the land. I promised you that you were going to be able to get the land. And now it's not so simple that you're going to be able to get the land. You're not able to get the land because you have to fight for it. Here I promised it to you, and now when he comes to Beri Sar, he has to negotiate and he has to handle. And that was the biggest test, because he should have said to God, wait a minute, it's mine. Our father, Zichrono Levracha, said that we understand in our generation the machloket between everybody else and the Rabbeinu Yonah. Because we had always thought that the last test for the Jewish people is the Akedah. In contemporary terms, that's the Shoah. After the Shoah, what kind of test could there be? This is the final test. And this wasn't just the Akedah. The Akedah, Yitzchak walked off. He walked off the Akedah. There were 6 million, and they were killed. What could be a greater test? And now we understand the Rabbeinu Yonah. There's another test. That the test of our generation is to be able to figure out a way how to live in the land of Israel peacefully and securely. And we have to humble, we have to figure this out, and we have to try to understand and how to do it. We're not done yet with the test of the Akedah. That's only number 9. Number 10 is how to be able to construct a reality that will allow us safely and securely to live in the state of Israel. May that be the case. That is something that clearly all of us are committed to. We need to work hard to try to ensure it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give us the bracha that the reshit should turn into the tzmichat. The tzmichat should turn into geulatenu at the right time. B'meirah b'yameinu. Amen. Thank you very much for coming.